Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. Doing well. I like nice weather. I like the nice time of year.
I agree. Now, have you seen the piece in the paper today about this Miller Brewing plant that had gone out of business in the 1990s?
Mm-hmm.
That is, they're switching it over to make it an ethanol production plant.
Which I really like that they're going to be reusing all the equipment in the plant, and they're just converting some of the existing equipment to be able to produce ethanol.
Here's from the newspaper, from the New York Times. With gas costing $3 a gallon in many parts of the country and much of the oil-producing world in turmoil, the lure of homegrown fuel is a powerful one, and Governor Pataki is intent on making the state the vanguard of ethanol production in the Northeast. The Fulton, New York plant is one of the projects in the region that is closest to fruition. And so what they're going to do there is they're converting this old beer brewery mm-hmm. to make ethanol.
Now, Francis and I don't talk about ethanol a lot. As a source from corn, because Francis and I don't necessarily believe that we should be producing more corn in order to produce ethanol, because ethanol is such a corn is such a fuel intensive food to make.
Yeah, we believe in biodiesel, and technically ethanol is a biofuel, right? What happens with, when you convert your car to run on biodiesel fuel? Now that's vegetable oil and corn oil from a number of different, mostly vegetable oil from a number of different sources, and it's oil that's often been used in restaurants to actually cook food in, and then instead of throwing it out, you can put it in your car and burn it, and it burns fairly cleanly. That's biodiesel. Ethanol is alcohol. And you can use it as an additive to gasoline, or if you have a specially adjusted automobile, some automobiles can run on an 85% ethanol, 15% gasoline mix. Now, while that does come from corn, and it does burn cleaner than regular gasoline.
Which is good. I mean, Francis and I believe in, you know, burning cleaner is better for the atmosphere. Using a product, a renewable product, is better.
But here's the problem. While biodiesel is cheaper than diesel fuel, or about the same, actually, as diesel fuel, ethanol is only cheaper because the production of corn is so heavily subsidized by our government that if the corn producers, who are not your family farms for the most part, but your huge corporate agribusiness corporations that get these monstrous tax breaks and subsidies, if those tax breaks and subsidies weren't taken away, then ethanol wouldn't be cheaper. It wouldn't make any sense. That's one problem.
Right. For me, that's not the biggest problem, because if we decide that we want to pay more to have a cleaner burning fuel and a fuel that's sustainable and renewable, I think that's a good circumstance.
Well, except that here's the problem. The way that corn is grown today, and obviously we're just talking with each other, we know this, and we're sort of nodding our heads in assent here in the studio, but you may not realize that the way corn is grown today, it's very intensive. It takes a lot of water, but more importantly, it takes a lot of fossil fuel to grow the corn in the first place. So corn, because a lot of our corn is genetically engineered.
And not just grow it. We're talking about transport it. We're talking about irrigate it. There are a lot of issues.
So to grow you need a lot of pesticides, which are petroleum-based. You need fertilizers. You need all sorts of chemicals that are petroleum-based to make corn grow. You then need to, it's very labor intensive, so to run the farm equipment, you need to spend more, you have more fossil fuels used in the production of corn. And so in the end, yes, you're getting this corn. So instead of burning gas, you're burning corn. But how much gas did you burn to make the corn? And so corn is really not the best solution for making ethanol to make the planet sustainable. And this plant, when it opens, will be a corn-based ethanol, because that's the most economically viable way to produce ethanol now. But they're thinking about making some changes. They're trying to do some research to make some changes.
Yeah, one of the concerns that I have in backing the whole ethanol program is that we will continue to make ethanol from corn. And if we continue to make ethanol from corn, I don't think it truly is sustainable. I don't think we've actually replaced petroleum with a better product just because of how we produce corn.
Well, now, but New York State is investing millions of dollars in research on corn-free ethanol. The State University of New York, I'm reading from the Times here, is spearheading that effort, which would produce ethanol using chips from willow trees instead. Now you're thinking they're going to go chop down all the willow trees, but no. They would pull out the things that are normally thrown away by a pulp and paper mill, said Neil Murphy, president of SUNY's College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse, which is also working with an international paper plant in Ticonderoga. So the idea is if they can make this ethanol from stuff that was going to be thrown away mm-hmm. from the paper-making process and utilize those trees better, that could really be a bio-friendly ethanol.
I think that you're using something that would otherwise be waste to try and create a fuel. It seems to make sense. I don't know what kind of power needs they have. I don't know that much about using paper detritus in order to create a fuel, but you know, it seems like a good idea.
Well, and I think one of the things we talk a lot about farming and how this is related to, you know, food, wine, and the finer things in life, is we talk a lot about farm subsidies and how our food is raised, and corn is a food. It can also be a fuel. You need to be very careful because corn is not about the family farmer, mm-hmm. okay? The kind of foods that we serve at the restaurant are about family farmer. The kind of foods from Heritage Foods USA and Slow Food, that's the kind of food from the family farmer. Ethanol commodity corn is grown by big corporate agribusiness, and it may not always be as ecologically or economically friendly as it looks on the face of it.
Sometimes when, you know, our tagline can be deceptive. It says food, wine, and the finer things in life, and then you hear us talking about ethanol, or you hear us talking about mad cow disease or one of these other topics. What we're trying to do when we talk about food, wine, and the finer things in life, well, those products come from certain places, and we're trying to preserve the finer things in life. And in order to preserve the finer things in life, we've got to preserve the family farm. We can't overuse petroleum. We should be farming more organically. We should be farming closer to home. We should be doing some of those things. And that's why you hear Francis and I talk about some of these issues that may not sound like the finer things in life, but they're how we get the finer things in life. They're how we keep the best foods on the planet. They're how we get to the best foods on the planet.
I was really moved by this story, though, and it's great for Fulton, New York, that this place is opening up again, mm-hmm. and hopefully they'll move to a more bio-friendly method of ethanol production, ecologically friendly method of ethanol production. But it talks about how they're talking about a guy who lives there who's working on the redevelopment of the plant, and he talks about the day in 1993 when he walked in and after working there for 15 years they told him it was going to close. And I remember my father's second job was driving for the Rheingold Brewing Company in Orange, New Jersey, and I remember he went to work one day, and then we got up in the morning and turned on the news and saw mm-hmm. there was a lockout, and that was the end of the Rheingold Brewing Company in Orange, New Jersey. Anyway, good for them up in Fulton, New York. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left in Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick. We're joined by our friend Nicholas Ferrari, owner of Restaurant Nicholas, just outside Red Bank in Middletown, New Jersey, on Route 35. And Nicholas, we asked him to come on the show because he's received a pretty extraordinary honor. He was rated an extraordinary, which in sort of the equivalent of 4 stars by the New York Times, just recently, which is the best rating you can get from the New York Times, and one of very few restaurants to hold that honor. Hey, Nicholas, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's is that good for business at all?
It's certainly good for business.
Well, now, how many restaurants have 3 stars? It's just three total have been awarded that in New Jersey in history, right?
I received an email from someone who did the research on that, and they told me that 3 restaurants in the history of the New Jersey section of the New York Times have received the extraordinary.
So that's pretty much in forever.
I guess I don't really know what the criteria was on it. We didn't do the research, but they said it was the first time in 6 years and only the third overall that it's ever received. So I'm glad someone did the research on that one.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Phone start ringing off the hook immediately.
Pretty much, a lot of congratulations from chefs, and a lot of flowers and plants came in, and
Mark.
I feel bad.
Call the flowers.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing one from you guys, but that's all right.
And, you got the congratulatory phone call, and you get to be on the radio show.
That is true. And let's see what else. On our email list, we had 400 emails of congratulations.
Well, wow, I sent you one great. Of those. They're free. They
so let me tell everyone who emailed, because we didn't email them back for thank you for that.
You just do a mass email back. Thanks for everybody.
Yeah, thanks, everybody, for the congratulations.
You guys are great.
What do you think you do differently than most restaurants in New Jersey that the Times recognized?
I can only tell you what we do. I don't know what we do differently.
I'm sure you do.
No, I don't. I could just say that right down to really, literally, the dishwashers in my restaurant, they're proud to work here. They are concerned about the reputation of the restaurant. I think that people in the dining room can tell. I think they can see that everyone who is taking care of them has true concern over whether or not they're enjoying their experience, and every cook in the kitchen is trying to do their best. Obviously, I'm trying to do my best in creation of these things and selection of the ingredients. And
I think you touch on a good point there, Nicholas, in that a lot of people realize that the front of house people, the waiters and the maitre d's and sommeliers, need to be people oriented and need to be concerned about what's happening in the dining room. But one of the things I think that people don't realize is how important the people in the back of the house are, as far as how much they care. Not just because a lot of people think it's just, well, it's the skill, it's the talent, that's what matters in the back of the house. But they have to care as much as the people in the front of the house.
Sure, because every little thing that happens, obviously, as the chef, I'm going to be overseeing, but there are times that you're just going to miss something, an over-seasoning of a dish, over-searing of a fish, whatever it might be, that you need a cook who cares enough to say, chef, I'm sorry, it's going to be 5 more minutes, I overcooked this, or something. We certainly don't want him to do that in the overcooking, but we do want him to stand up and say, this is where the mistake is, I don't want a customer to receive this. And
sure.
We have that kind of stuff. There's
sure.
No doubt.
And in most businesses, it's better to slide your mistakes under the rug, as it were, and just try and skate by rather than try and fix them.
Right. I think also when you read David Corcoran's reviews, he is very, very concerned about the food. Not to say that he's not concerned about the service and the appearance of the restaurant and all those things, but I would probably say 3.5 of the 4 stars or whatever, however the rating system goes just to food, which might be a little bit lopsided in comparison to other food reviewers.
Mm-hmm.
When you say that the kitchen is important and the people who work in the kitchen caring, in this particular case, it's extremely important.
Let me throw this question out to you, Nicholas. If you were to sell a restaurant tomorrow and become a restaurant reviewer, when you went into a place that was aspiring to be 4 stars, what percentage, if 3.5 out of 4 stars are dependent upon the kitchen, is that how you would view things as well as a reviewer, or do you think the dining room is at least 1 or 1.5 stars of what goes on?
Yeah, I'm not going to knock the way Mr. Corcoran reviews. So
yeah,
I'm
I wouldn't
gonna,
do that if I were you.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that.
Well, he probably won't be back for a few years now. So
yeah, I'm not going to say that I would do it differently. I would just say that first is, if I was to retire, I wouldn't make a whole lot of money as a food reviewer, because I think I might be illiterate. English, I'm not sure, is my first language in writing. But I would take the dining room into account tremendously. I obviously do here. I spend 50% of the time in the dining room and 50% of the time in the kitchen. I think that an overall dining experience is what the customers, what the people who come to the restaurant are going to view. I'm not going to say that customers couldn't tell the difference between 3.5-star and 4-star food, but they can definitely tell the difference between 3-star and 4-star service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's no question in my mind people can detect that. What? And I think that if you're coming for your 25th wedding anniversary, your celebration of your first anniversary, a birthday, just a promotion, whatever it might be, you want to remember that experience, and we have an obligation as the restaurant that they're coming to take care of them in every way. And if we don't concern ourselves with the food and the hospitality end of this thing, we concern ourselves, with just the food and not the hospitality mm-hmm. and the service of it, people won't remember that the steak or whatever it is, the squab is perfectly cooked. They would remember that the server gave them an attitude or whatever.
I think we have an obligation to make them feel good, not just give them great food.
When we come back, I want to talk more with Nicholas, owner of the four-star restaurant Nicholas in Middletown, New Jersey, about hospitality and when you evaluate a restaurant, whether you look more toward the food or the service aspect of things and what it exactly is we're looking for when we evaluate a restaurant. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everyone, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi, Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Nicholas Harari. He is the owner with his wife, Melissa, of Restaurant Nicholas in Middletown, New Jersey, which just received one of only three times that the New York Times New Jersey section has awarded an extraordinary, our New Jersey equivalent of 4 stars, to his restaurant. And that's a pretty damn good achievement you got going on there, Nicholas.
You know what the greatest thing about being called extraordinary as opposed to getting 4 stars is?
What?
That every time we've received a number of 4-star reviews in our 6 years here, and my mother always calls up and says, "How come you didn't get 5? So when she sees extraordinary, she knows, "Oh, that must be the highest rating," and she finally congratulates.
You know,
very nice.
That's true. That's not a joke.
I know. Well, we had the same thing. We've gotten 4 stars in a number of publications. Never quite the New York Times, Mr. Fancy Pants, but we're trying. But we've gotten 4 stars in a number of publications, and people say, "Oh, too bad you didn't get 5," and you're like, "No, they don't give 5. That's a hotel. Hotels get 5.
Well, and then the other thing, you have the Michelin
guide
scale, where 1 star, you know, is a great review, and in the United States we think of 1 star as
I'm,
you know,
sorry.
Awful.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly, 1 star. If somebody told me I got 1 star from one of the publications that we're talking about, I'd be like, ow.
And you know what's interesting is I get, and tell me if this happens to you as well. I mean, we obviously get a lot of resumes, but I get resumes on people's resumes. They'll put that they worked at, you know, this restaurant which got 5 stars. This 5-star restaurant.
I get that a lot too, actually.
Isn't that weird?
I think it's kind of strange.
You're like 5 stars from what? First of all, and secondly, that's not possible. Isn't that weird?
It is a little strange. I get that once in a while. I try not to fault the person because it's probably coming from the top down.
Right.
Well, it's probably coming from a publication, too. Some publication that said, you know what, we'll make our publication 5 stars.
I don't think so. I don't think it's coming from publications. I think it's just coming from, you know,
the owners of the restaurant.
Yeah.
I have to say, though, when it comes to this whole star thing and the review thing and all that kind of stuff, really, and I truly mean this, the only thing that really matters is what the customers say leaving your place. And I really, truly think that everyone who comes here is a food reviewer,
mm-hmm.
and we have that in the back of our mind all the time. Because I had someone who congratulated me the other day in the restaurant, and I said, "Well, thanks." And I said, "Well, you know, I make that comment to say, you know, I'm more concerned about what you have to say than what the food reviewer has to say. Because if at the end of this meal you say not so good, I wouldn't bring up the New York Times review and say, 'No, it was extraordinary.'" Look,
we'll be back after the news. We're going to continue on with this topic with Nicholas Harari, owner of Restaurant Nicholas. You can find a link to his place on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. It's one of our favorite restaurants in state of New Jersey, second favorite maybe. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Nicholas Harari. Nicholas, with his wife Melissa, own restaurant Nicholas in Middletown on Route 35 in New Jersey. It's one of the best restaurants in New Jersey, in our opinion, and Nicholas is a friend. So we had a couple of, like, wine geek egghead shows this week. This is our chatty show with our buddy. So, Nicholas, we were talking before the break about, you know, this four stars, and just if anyone's just tuned in, four stars has been awarded to New Jersey restaurants, or the extraordinary is what they call it, rating has been awarded by the New York Times, only three times in history. And so this is a pretty big deal here. And we were talking about, how you, and I think we agree with the philosophy, you need to treat your dining room, if you want to get four stars, like there's a four-star, like there's the New York Times restaurant critic is in your dining room every night. Because not only because one of these nights he's going to be, but also because, you know, the Times restaurant critic, while they'll spread the word to a lot of people, mm-hmm. those people will come and try you once.
Right.
And if they get there and it's not up to snuff, you're done.
But one of the things that is unfortunate in our business and fortunate at the same time, because restaurant reviewers have the power to bring a lot of people through your door for that first visit. But, you know, you touched on the fact of, well, you know, every diner is as important as the restaurant reviewer. And in the way I feel about them, that's true. But in the dollars and cents of it, a restaurant reviewer has the power to bring a lot of people through the door. So when a restaurant reviewer thinks highly of you, there has to be some weight put on that.
Yeah, I mean, it does have more weight than one individual customer. But when the customer said to me, you know, we are not food reviewers. And I said, well, when mm-hmm. you leave tonight, if you didn't enjoy your experience, would you tell people?
Right.
And they say, yeah.
Of
and
course.
I said, no, you're a food reviewer.
Of
done.
Course.
Yeah.
And although a food reviewer can bring something to you very quickly in bursts, over the long haul, you'd be better off if you just had all your people leaving thinking that you were great. Of course, it helps if the food reviewer is helping send people to your
right.
to your establishment. I do think that in New Jersey, a restaurant can survive with a negative food review from the New York Times.
There's no doubt about it.
It certainly helps that you have one that is good. In New York City, however, I do not think a restaurant can survive with a negative food review from
Let's
the New York
talk
Times.
About that. I think that's a very interesting concept, and I agree 100%. Why do you think that is?
I think that, in general, there's so many restaurants in New York that people just are going to, you know, take things with more importance when they read the New York Times. There, you know, they have many restaurants they can choose from, so mm-hmm. they're just going to say, okay, we'll go to that one instead because
right.
they got a negative review. I think in New Jersey, there are certainly some good restaurants, but they're few and further between than in Manhattan.
Well, I think the reality is if you live in Red Bank and you like really, really good restaurants, you're going to go to Restaurant Nicholas sooner or later and formulate your own opinion.
Yeah, that's probably true. Where in the city, it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in the city, that food review means everything. I know because I worked at Jean Georges when we got four stars, and it was just a totally different kind of you know, restaurant at that time. As soon as the review comes out, and I've luckily never been in a restaurant that got a negative food review, but I can only imagine it's not good.
Well, you know, again, I think it matters less in Jersey. I think that in Jersey and Long Island and most of the country, a negative food review does you no good, but it also does you very little harm. I think that in a way, look, when publications, and don't get this confused, because there are publications out there that only write positive things,
mm-hmm.
and they don't matter at all because people don't. They know
they matter. They're like putting an ad up or putting press
right,
out there. I mean, they matter for that reason.
But the fluff publications, people read it and immediately realize that it's not a valid.
It's not a critique.
There's no valid information on the restaurant because they're only going to say positive things.
Mm-hmm.
It can't all be good, you know. But what I will say is that publications like the New York Times and the Star Ledger, and New Jersey Monthly, who will say good or bad things about a restaurant. If they say bad things about you, but your customers like you anyway, I think you're absolutely right, Nicholas. It doesn't hurt.
Right.
If they say good things about you, they'll drive people to your door. Where I think that the issue is in Jersey, we don't need to replace our customers as often. And what people look for in Jersey is when you have a regular customer, they come in once a week. In our more casual restaurant, Kathleen Lombardi, we have regular customers who come in three times a week.
Right.
I think in New York.
Yeah, you don't see that.
You don't see that as much, and people. You need to replace your customers. Somebody new has to always be coming to your restaurant.
Yeah, but that's probably not just New Jersey. I think it's a suburban thing.
I agree.
I think that in general, people in the city tend to need to go to the restaurant that's the it place because everyone's kind of talking about it, and they say, did you go to restaurant X? And the people would be like, well, I've never been there, and then, you know, they don't have anything to add to the conversation. It's sort of like people have to go to these places that everyone is going to. And in New Jersey, I think people are, or in the suburbs, I think people are going to go to the place that the food and the service is the best.
Actually, Nicholas, I think we went to Restaurant X together, didn't we?
I didn't mean... That's funny. That is true. We did go.
Friend Nicholas and I went to a restaurant called X.
Oh, that's right. You did.
That's funny.
Oh, God.
You should have used Y.
Yeah, maybe. Next time.
Dorks. So, the other thing is, when you are in New York, and I live in Jersey City, and I like to go out in New York a lot, I tend to go back to favorites. I have a favorite place, which is sort of my what I call my local. It's not really my neighborhood, but I go there all the time. It's a place called Hearth. It's owned by Paul Greco, formerly of Gramercy Tavern, and his partner is formerly of Kraft. I forget his partner's name. Great, and I'm sort of known there, you know, and I like that. I like going to a place where I know them. They change their menu enough to be interesting. The wine list is great, and they say, hey, Francis, welcome back. How are you?
But not just that. They know the things I like. They know the things I dislike. They point me towards something new and interesting because they know I like new and interesting things.
And I think that you find that more out here in the burbs. I think in New York, there's always, you know, because I get Time Out New York, and I get New York Magazine, and because of the show and because we're interested, we get emails all the time. And there's always a list of 10 places that you got to try.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that and if you don't come back on that list in New York because you were in some publication and written about the new thing that you did, they remember that they had a great meal there, but people are always looking for something new.
Sure. Hey, do you ever sit at the counter at Hearth?
No, I don't like the counter. I don't like counters. I don't want to look into a kitchen. And being in the business, and this will go out there, I never like, and Mark and I have done it a few times, and we always feel punished. I don't want to sit at the chef's table. I don't want to sit in the kitchen. I don't want to sit in the counter, and I don't want to look in the kitchen. I work in one every day.
Way too much food in the kitchen of my own restaurant.
If I didn't work in a restaurant, I would feel completely different. I think it's a great thing, and I'm not saying we wouldn't do one day. But me, every time I walk through the dining room into the chef's table, I think, oh, can I sit in the dining room with all the nice carpet?
That's fine.
Well, what do you think? Do you eat at the counter there?
I've had dinner at the counter there because we have a counter. We have our chef's table, but we also have a what we call a chef's pass table, which is very similar to Hearth's, that you can actually sit right on the same counter, in essence, that the chefs are plating all the food on. So you're like, you have a bird's eye view of the whole thing. That actually, we're starting to book that in September.
See, I think that's fabulous and interesting and nice. And I think when you go to a restaurant that has a chef's table, you're assured of the fact that that kitchen is clean and well run, because if they're inviting you into the kitchen to watch them cook, that's a great mark of professionalism for the kitchen. I just don't want to sit there. Nicholas, can I sit in the corner when I come next time?
Fair enough.
Out in the dining room?
Most likely you were going to be in the corner anyway, Francis.
He tries to keep us away from his other patrons.
Hey, the other thing that I thought this review said is that you had done a renovation through this whole thing, and your renovation is now done, and you opened a new place. One of the things he commends you on in this review is that you would never know that you were having a renovation happen, having all this construction go on while you stayed open. How'd you manage that?
A lot of hard work on a lot of people's part. My staff was amazing through the construction every day, as you've done it yourself, breakdown, setup, dust, polish. The builder did a great job in building walls, taking walls down. We literally, at one point, were painting at 4:30, a fake wall that we were putting in so people couldn't see, so people can come in at 5:30, and hopefully no one leaned against it, which didn't happen. I mean, we had that on more than one occasion. We had one time where we had to buy a temporary carpet that we had to actually literally staple down so people wouldn't trip on it. We had all kinds of things, but, you know, during the whole 11 months of construction, I don't think that we received any complaint from anyone about, you know, the fact that it was under construction. Of course, you know, we're not doing hammering and this kind of stuff during dining times, and once you're in the building, you couldn't tell because everyone did so much work to make it so you couldn't.
Nicholas, we received a lot of complaints while we were under construction, but they were all from our employees who had to dust and paint and staple carpets down.
Yeah, we had some of those, but I had to get over it.
Hey, listen, when we come back, we're going to be talking more with our friend Nicholas Harari. He owns Restaurant Nicholas, one of the best restaurants in Jersey down in Middletown. You can go to their website, which is restaurantnicholas.com, link to it through our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants, and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left, Captain Lombardi Restaurant in Connecticut. Our guest today is fellow restaurateur Nicholas Harari, who owns Restaurant Nicholas down in Middletown, New Jersey. If you haven't tried it, you should check it on out.
So, Nicholas, we're talking about your four-star review here, and I think that one of the things that we need to touch on in this really, really spectacular review you got from the New York Times is the timing of this. You've just expanded your restaurant. Okay, it's a bigger restaurant. You've added a bar area and a small plates menu and some really interesting things. But I think that one of the great compliments that you get by getting a review like this when that's happened is, I think any time a business expands, any time a restaurant expands especially, there's a concern that that you're going to diminish quality. So to have a review like this come right on the tails of an expansion like that, I think is an even bigger compliment than what you would normally have.
Thanks. I agree. I think that it was great timing because it was one of the things that I had said all along during construction. People kept saying, oh, it's not going to be as good, it won't be as intimate, all these kinds of things. And I said, no, we're not adding that many more tables. We're adding a new entrance, a new bar and lounge, and a brand new kitchen. And yes, we're expanding a private dining area, which can be used for regular dining, but it's not like we're going from 65 covers to 150 covers or seats. We went from 65 seats to 95 seats plus a bar and lounge. But still, I'm sure everyone had to worry that it's not going to be as good. And then, you know, here we go. And he actually told me, Mr. Corcoran, in an interview that he interviewed me to fact check, he told me that he came in right after Valentine's Day within that week. And I knew that we opened the new space like the day before Valentine's Day. So we were only, and he had mentioned in it that he had only been here 1 week after the expansion was completed, and he had come back on other occasions after that, but he had no idea that we were only open like that for 7 days.
That's great. I mean, it's a concern. I mean, even in expanding my own business, it's something I worry about and kind of, you know, obsess over to make sure that everything stays at the level or actually gets better.
Right. The last thing in the world you want to do is spend $1.5 million on something and then have people tell you, oh, by the way, it's not as good.
Right.
You know, the other thing that we talk about, you know, about not screwing up service during construction, because with Stage Left, we've expanded. You know, we started as a 50-seat restaurant with, you know, the bar was in the middle of the dining room, and now we have, you know, 130 seats with four private dining rooms on two floors, and now the second restaurant upstairs. And that the Stage Left, I mean, Catherine Lombardi was built all at once, but Stage Left was one dining room, and then we scraped enough money to buy another dining room, and then we scraped up enough money to buy and refinish another dining room. And as we went through these expansions, one of the things that, you know, we did and what you've just done is, and you touched on it earlier, you know, somebody's coming for their anniversary. Somebody's coming, maybe it's somebody who has a lot of money and can dine that way 5 nights a week, and they can go wherever they want, so you have one set of concerns with them. Maybe it's somebody who saved up their money for a very special occasion. They go out like that once a year or once every 5 years, and they're coming into dinner. You can't screw up their dinner.
You can't say, oh, sorry about the dust in your glass, ma'am. You know, we're under construction.
It's a big responsibility. I mean, do you agree with that?
I do. I do. It concerned me before construction tremendously. We had actually projected to be off 35% for the year because we knew that you know, construction would keep people away, and it turned out to be the opposite. Everyone came during construction. We were up 10% on the year, and the restaurant was half the size it was for a year. And that put the pressure even more on us that, you know, people are going to continue to come, and thankfully so, but you have a responsibility to people that people don't care whether or not it's you're going through tough things and renovations. People care that it's their anniversary, their birthday, their special occasion, their night out, whatever it is. And your problems are not their problems, and don't make them so.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about responsibility. I had a couple come in the other night. They said, "Yeah, we've wanted to come here for 10 years. We've been, you know, my wife's been talking about coming here for 10 years. Well, we finally came. We finally made it, and you know, you exceeded our expectations. Everything's been spectacular. Well, that feels really great. You know, that's what I'm looking for. I can't say to the guy who's waited 10 years to come to my restaurant, oh, by the way, you know, sorry, your squab
is overcooked. You know, I'll buy a free dessert. You know, I mean, that's, you know." And that's the thing about owning a special occasion place, especially, I think, is that, you know, for some people, they're really momentous. Like, even if you bought, if you screwed up, even if you bought them another dinner.
Yeah, it doesn't help.
There's no do-over. You know what I mean?
Well, I tell my staff all the time that this is a performance, no different than what you would see in an opera house or in a Broadway show, that if someone hits the wrong note, if an actor trips on the stage, if you spill wine on someone's lap, if you've overcooked some squab or whatever it is, there is no do-over. You'll never be able to take back that missed note,
right,
that trip on stage, or that overcooked piece of meat. It can't happen because you have screwed up the idea of a perfect dining experience, and there's nothing you're going to be able to do.
Right. It's like they're watching a performance and the set fell down.
That's
you
right.
Can put the set back up, but
yeah.
you don't get back into the show.
But the set fell down.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And I, to prove that point, I say it all the time. So you buy someone dinner. Are they going to leave and not tell people that the squab was overcooked? No, they're still going to tell, and it doesn't. You're in trouble the moment it happens, and that's why you know you have to do your hardest to make sure that it doesn't happen.
Well, but I think to be engaged with people, and I think that, you know, we talked about New York versus New Jersey. I think that one of the nice things we get out here is to be able to be engaged with our guests and sort of get to know them. And you know, if you do make one mistake, you know, and we all make some mistakes, if you're part and parcel of the dining experience, maybe it's a little more forgiving.
Yeah, sure. But doesn't make it right.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Hey, we'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Nicholas Harari from Restaurant Nicholas in Middletown, New Jersey. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Stage left in Capital Party Restaurants here with Nicholas Harari. Just got an extraordinary, one of three in history, an extraordinary review from the New York Times for Restaurant Nicholas. You can find out about his website on ours, restaurantguysradio.com. Nicholas, David Corcoran in the New York Times says that you have evolved. And I thought this was really great. He said, more than the building has changed. In 5 years, Mr. Harari, who was precocious in 2001, he was just 27 and fresh from a tour as Boy Wonder Sommelier at John George, is now guiding his namesake restaurant with a burnished confidence that shows up in every aspect of the experience. Were you really precocious?
I don't know. I don't know what it means.
Have you really evolved? I thought maybe you had an extra digit or something before.
I think I've probably matured a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean, the question is, do you think you run your restaurant differently today than you did 5 years ago? Are you doing things differently today in one way or another?
I think that I'm probably more intense today than I was 5 or 6 years ago, which isn't showing up in the dining room as much. I think that's because my staff has matured as well, and I recognize the fact that my intenseness makes people a little bit tight, a little bit stiff, and that's not the greatest thing for customers to see. But I am who I am. I can't change that, and I'm not going to change that.
Well, Nicholas, we like you just the way you are, and I want to thank you for coming on the show. That was nice. Come on. That was all of life's a song cue.
Awful
anyway,
it was.
Thanks for coming on the show to talk to us. I'm going to come down and eat at your place soon.
Thanks, Nicholas.
My pleasure.
That's super. That was Restaurant Nicholas owner Nicholas Harari, who with his wife Melissa owns Restaurant Nicholas in Middletown. If you haven't been, you need to go. When he opened his doors 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we thought immediately one of the best restaurants in the state. And we happened to know him before he opened up, and we've forged a great relationship ever since.
Really a special little restaurant, and I encourage everyone to go.
Yeah, and it's special, but it's also a real family-run place. It's him and his wife, Melissa. They're both there, and it's very cozy and real and warm, and I like it a lot. Kind of like you and me. No.
Get away from me.
So hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, times 12 noon.